Welcome to WRTI's Classical Stream, made possible by contributions from listeners like you. Learn more at WRTI.org.
We are often fortunate to have the opportunity to interview visiting artists when they perform here in Philadelphia. And we caught up several months ago with piano virtuoso Louis Lortie. He was performing with the Philadelphia Orchestra. He is known for his interpretation of works by Ravel, Chopin, and Beethoven. Mr. Lortie was born in Quebec. He debuted at the age of 13 with the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, won first prize both in the Busoni and the Leeds competition in the same year, 1984. He's also a recipient of the Knight of the National Order of Quebec, an officer of the Order of Canada, and teaches in the prestigious Piano Institute in Italy, the Imola Institute. He performs internationally. And he lives in Berlin. He has an enormous list of recordings, and we were so fortunate to catch him in between performances, and here he is. Welcome, Monsieur Lortie, here.
My pleasure.
To WRTI. You are originally from Montreal, is that right?
Yes.
And you are now living abroad, is that right?
Yes.
Well, and you are here in Philadelphia to give a concert at the Kimmel Center. And we are very lucky to have you for the few minutes today to speak with us on Crossover. You are you specifically interested in a particular composer? How are you driven to do repertoire of a particular composer?
Not really. You know, I do concentrate in periods on certain composers, but from my early youth, I mean, from my childhood, I was very, very curious about different types of repertoire, and I've always thought that I want to keep it open. You know, I do have bouts of going into the Germanic or the French or Chopin or whatever. And it's very difficult when you have so many interests, of course, to seclude yourself and say, I'm going to do this period now. But, you know, life, things happen like anniversaries. I always liked it because, in a way, it's an excuse to go back to a composer that you love. You know, like this year, Chopin. In a way, it's a fantastic way for an artist to sort of sum up, you know, I'm 50, so I sum up all the years I've spent with that composer and decided to do a few discs of Chopin and a few recital programs and the concertos. And, you know, maybe there will be another excuse in 25 years if I'm again around to go back a lot to Chopin again. Of course I will. I will constantly go back to him, but I mean on a larger scale.
But he's
scale.
Very demanding. I mean, technically, Chopin, a lot of his things are.
Yes, I would say even, yes, of course, but also emotionally.
Ah.
I would say like most great romantic composers, you know, they are. And don't forget, they were drawn to the instrument very, very early. Another great composer, of course, who has his bicentennial now is Schumann.
Schumann is, this is the Schumann and the Schubert year for some reason. I don't know. Schumann, of course, very important, but a lot of people are recording Schubert as well and, or rediscovering it. And I say that in quotes, Schubert, because I guess the more you delve, the more you discover that things don't change that much in terms of composition. I mean, there is always the same motivation of love and longing and passion and so on and so forth. I mean, that is all music, really, pretty much. And I guess we discover it in different ways with, you know, according to the century. It's more overt as we get into the Romantic period, but, certainly Chopin, I think, was certainly a romantic, very, very much a romantic.
Yes, but what's really interesting in the last years is that, you know, Chopin was, for many, many years, many decades even after his death, considered, you know, sort of a sentimental composer and associated with the salon. And,
yes, yes.
And then suddenly, you know, I would say maybe 30 years ago, 40 years ago, people started to take him much more seriously. Went into, even musicologists, went to study his music in a much more, in a deeper way and saw his links to the, you know, he always said he loved Mozart and Bach and the classics. And then suddenly people started to discover that beneath all this bel canto veneer, there was a very, very, very astute and very, very learned, master of the counterpoint and
of
inner voices and And this is the aspect that had been sort of neglected. So nowadays we have all these multiple facets of Chopin in front of us, and it continues to, I would say, to intrigue people
and yes,
pique their curiosity. Yes, yes. And actually, if you look at it in the last years, there has been an incredible number of publications about Chopin, both in the musicology field and in the grand public. I mean, if you go just to Barnes and Nobles, you will see an incredible number of books, whether it's about, you know, Chopin's life in Paris, his relation to his contemporaries, or his death, or, you know, that everything about the trajectory of that man who left his home country early, was forced to go, and also was of a very ambiguous origin, because his father came from France, but he had been, you know, immersed in Polish culture so early. So there was this incredible mixture already in his background, and no great composer had yet been produced by Poland. So this is this whole mixture, and then Chopin being interested in very different things, like the bel canto that was being composed as he was living, Bellini especially.
Yes, yes.
And then, but then at the same time, he loved the classics. He loved the order of the classics. He played a lot of Well-Tempered Clavier by Bach. You can feel it in any of his compositions.
Well, I was going to ask you, because your interpretation of Chopin, even you have been known to say that you are rediscovering things as you learn. I imagine that's what happens when you perform. You rediscover, or you find new ways of saying the same thing. But as you say, there's probably a very strong musical influence in terms of the way the music is going, rather than the embroidery or the embellishment, which you really associate with much of Chopin, mm-hmm. you know, and also technical, you know, difficulty as well. You had a very interesting thing that I saw on your website about connecting the etudes. There are various ways that you not position them as much as musically join them.
Yes. Well, there's a whole psychology, of course. Nowadays, you know, we all say, where are we going with the recital? You know, this institution of the recital with the coattails and all of this has been existing forever. What do we do with it? Is it still valid? Is it redundant? How do we build a piano recital to make sense with it? I think it's still an interesting question, you know.
Well,
I think people go to a concert for an experience.
Yes.
Definitely now that we can listen to any kind of music at home in the best conditions, mm-hmm. when we go to a concert, we want it to be a special experience. And of course, part of that special experience is building something. You know, you just don't put one piece after another like this as a virtuoso showcase. It doesn't make sense. So you try to build a kind of dramaturgy sometimes, especially mm-hmm. when you play romantic music in the way you build the recital program. So I think for me, that's part of the recital experience. So I think that's what I'm explaining a little bit on the website.
Yes. The other thing is, of course, it's very revealing, a solo recital. I mean, that's, you're it. And it's an intellectual experience as well, as opposed to an orchestral. And I say that more not for the layman, but for the concert goer. I think that they have to really want to hear what you're doing, or the artist is doing, in a solo recital.
Yes, because of course, as you said, there is an abstract part in just seeing this one person.
That's
especially
it.
When it's a pianist, just this one person with 88 keys, you know. It's not, of course, there is a part of it that's visually challenging, but much less than the orchestra, and there's certainly less variety. But I think people are still drawn to this, the curiosity of this incredible relationship, and also especially this mysterious instrument made of hammers that pretends to just sing all the time, especially if you're playing Chopin.
Well, he played on a different instrument, though, of course.
That's true, but it was still hammers hitting a string, you know.
Yes.
That's what's amazing. And in all the music of Chopin, there's very little percussive. There's maybe sometimes in the Polonaise, there will be a little figuration that has something percussive, but that's very elusive. Most of it is about, I would say, bypassing the terrestrial facts of a piano and the decay of sound. I think he was obsessed with giving the impression that the piano was a singing instrument, that the piano could imitate the voice, that the piano had an illimited possibility of multiple voices going at the same time with different types of expression. So it's a very, very rich tapestry. And I think in a concert hall, it can gain also. I think that's why going to a Chopin recital live still nowadays is an experience.
Well, I think that people never took him too seriously because they enjoyed it so much. And, you know, very often, you know, there's an intellectual approach
that's
where you,
true.
If you love something and it's so melodic mm-hmm. and it's so passionate and, you know, how good can it be? Well, of course.
Exactly.
It's
but there was also the fact maybe that he wrote mostly small pieces.
Yes.
I mean, at least in duration.
Yes.
And that's sure, another aspect that people discovered, that even in his ballad or his scherzos, he had very, very, very interesting constructions, and he had a very unusual way of using the sonata form. So even if a piece was only of a 10-minute duration, it could have the scope of a real long piece in the way that it was built, which was a very, very, you know, he was a perfectionist. He would work sometimes for months and for years on something to get a certain result. And we know that it sounds easy, but we know at the end of his life, composition became very, very difficult for him because he wanted to go further away, you know, tonally and harmonically. And he really did some incredible work at the end of his life harmonically was very, very far-fetched. And still some works of Chopin from his last years are very difficult even for the audience to, if you think only of the Polonaise Fantasy, you know, it's a work that has that intrigues everybody because it's difficult to understand the meaning of such a work and play it, as I would say, with unity. You know, it's also a
picture. I mean, it really is. It's a tone poem in a sense.
Yes, absolutely. For piano, he certainly was writing already something that could be called tone poem.
Do you play the Minute Waltz in a minute?
Well, you know, that's another part of Chopin, that the encore and the salon world, which of course we have lost touch with nowadays. So it's a little bit more difficult to integrate. But still, when there is room after a performance for encores, there are lots of those pieces.
Now, another of my favorites, and I wonder if he was yours or is yours, Maurice Ravel, of course. And I have a bone to pick with you because I am a harpist, and you have recorded the introduction in Allegro, and you're not allowed to do that.
You know, pianists, I always say we are perverts because we have all this repertoire. There's nobody in the world that has more repertoire than a pianist, and still we manage to play all those silly transcriptions.
Well, and harp has very little repertoire. That's ours.
I know, and we stole it, but we do that to everybody, don't worry.
Oh, my goodness, but it's really fascinating. You do have an album that we have here at the station for two piano works. And I said, oh, no, they can't do that. You know, but in any case, what do we have to look forward to now after your concert, after your performances here? Are you touring?
Yes, I'm touring this country now with after the Philadelphia with the Gewandhaus of Leipzig.
Wonderful.
With Ricardo Chailly. And we are all around the country. We're on the West Coast.
And you're performing these?
I'm doing Chopin number one with them. I was here doing number two.
Number two,
also doing the fifth of Beethoven.
Mm. Mm. Okay. Now you have to explain that.
Well, I guess, you know, again, it's either anniversaries or requests. You know, the Gewandhaus, of course, is associated with the classics, the German classics.
Yes.
And believe it or not, I didn't even know this, that the Emperor Concerto was created about 200 years ago in Leipzig, of all places, because Beethoven was deaf and he was not creating his pieces anymore in Vienna. I mean, he could not perform the fifth concerto because he was, by that time, he could not play his own music.
I had heard that he couldn't hear at all.
At this stage. So somebody else played this concerto in a hall that doesn't exist anymore, but I was shown where this hall was. I was shown a drawing of the hall. It's fascinating to see, you know, when you go to Leipzig and you see everything that happened there, all these composers Even Chopin went through Leipzig, met Mendelssohn, but never managed to really play. You know, Chopin was the one who was forever elusive and not very well of his health. And it's incredible to see, to read the description, for example, of Mendelssohn, of his encounter with Chopin there in Leipzig.
Well, you know, you must go through all kinds of experiences just researching what happened when the music was written or where it was written. I mean, that is a very powerful. You can play differently, I think.
Of course, everybody has his take, you know, on tradition. Of course, the Gewandhaus of Leipzig went through a few generations until we reached this time. So things might have changed quite a lot, you know, but still, it's still fascinating to see how these people who live there and have been living with this tradition, play this music and conceive it. So it's a nice, nice injection of new ideas.
What magnificent music to play. So how long is your tour?
Until the end of February.
The end of February. And then where you live in Berlin.
Yeah.
And will you be, do you teach? Do you
I
lecture?
Used to teach more regularly in a piano institute, in an academy in Imola in Italy, but it's a lot of traveling and now I prefer to do it on a smaller scale, sometimes at home.
Well, I hope that you will return to Philadelphia once.
Oh, it's always
again.
A pleasure, and you know, your orchestra is just
it's
fearless.
Wonderful.
It really
and,
is.
And you really are such a fine, fine artist, and I'm so delighted that we had just a chance to speak a little bit with you. And thank you so very much.
I'll come back anytime.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.